A word from today's sponsor. Embodia is an all-in-one platform for rehab professionals and our patients. I love using Embodia because it includes a complete practice management for charting, scheduling, billing, and online booking. Plus, Embodia has digital exercise prescription, program monitoring, secure two-way messaging, waitlist management, in-depth reporting, and so much more. As an added bonus, there's a library of continuing education courses and regular live webinars so that you can continue to learn while you build your practice. Visit EmbodiaApp.com and use the code MOMSTRENGTH to get $20 off your first month's Tier 3 membership. Welcome to Mom Strength, a podcast and movement to empower, educate, and showcase mom strength inside and out. I'm your host, Surabhi Veach, physiotherapist and fitness coach, also known as the Passionate Physio. Join me for discussions on movement, mindset, and motherhood, where we raise the bar and challenge the status quo. Get ready for expert interviews and real, honest conversations where we explore physical, mental, and emotional health. Let's celebrate the beautiful diversity and common experiences in all of our journeys. Let's do this. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Mom Strength. I'm your host, Surabhi Veach, and I'm here today with Rebecca Drury, who is a speech-language pathologist, and she is awesome, and she's amazing with kids, I can tell you firsthand. She owns and operates Bespoke Speech, a distinguished private speech therapy practice in Midtown Toronto, with a mission to empower parents and caregivers in supporting their children's communication skills. Rebecca and her small team of amazing speech therapists offer speech therapy to preschools who have a variety of speech needs. Rebecca is also the creator of Bespoke Speech's signature interactive baby program called Babbling Babies. This innovative baby program was born out of Rebecca's personal experience as a mom on back-to-back maternity leaves with two sons and her extensive expertise in the field of speech therapy. This program offers a place for caregivers and their babies to connect and bond together while offering tips and ideas to encourage their babies' play and language development. Amazing. You've done so much. I'm so excited to have you on here, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get started with
who
is an ideal client to go to speech language, speech therapy?
That's a great starting question. I think my thoughts on speech therapy has changed ever since I became a mom. I think before I became a mom, I would have said anyone who is not meeting their communication milestones, that's another whole tangent on itself, because if you go and Google online, you're going to see different milestones. But for me, since I became a mother, I think the number one question that parents should ask themselves is my child frustrated by their communication, or am I frustrated by their communication, or both? And I think if anyone in the family is frustrated or feeling upset or has a lot of questions, that's the time to get a speech language pathologist involved. I'm all about bringing anxiety levels down for parents.
Yes.
And so that's how I see speech therapy now, is you're not sure, you're frustrated, you're anxious, you're nervous about it, get it done.
Yeah. And because often in the medical system, they'll wait till you're already not meeting the milestones. And sometimes those milestones are, I don't know what you think of them, but sometimes I'm like, isn't that kind of late to then get help? Or isn't it better to get help earlier if you can? But there's probably a gray area between like rushing to get help, you know, because there's a lot of parents who put so much pressure on their like tiny babies to figure everything out right away too. Mm-hmm. So how do you play with that?
Great question too. So I think let's look at both ends of like rushing too early or waiting too late. Let's look at both ends. So too late, again, that's why online is so difficult to really parse out, and why meeting one-on-one with a speech therapist who can look at your child with their lens only on your child. Different schools, depending on where you are, whether you're in Ontario, the States is a whole other thing. Another province is another thing. So for example, the school board, they base their need, because they have really, it's publicly funded service. You are waiting up until, depending on the school board, up to 4 years to get speech therapy.
Wow.
So because their wait lists are so high, let's say in one school board, they have very strict parameters on what you will be eligible for. So for example, an R sound, they will say not until 8. Why not until 8? Because that's when it's considered significant, really severe. Whereas what we know in terms of typical development for a child, R should be in by 5 years of age. So that's why it's so tricky. That's why there's this gray area. It's like, well, the school board is saying not until 8, but this person, this private SLP is saying 5. As a parent, who do I listen to? And I think it's really important to, again, is start young, and we'll go to the other side, is you have to really understand where is that funding coming from, because you don't want to wait until 8, because the longer you wait, you also have, especially with school age children, with whatever the area is, you also have to consider their awareness, their self-awareness. You have to look at confidence. You have to look at self-motivation. So when I work with an 8-year-old versus a 5-year-old, I'm not just, you know, we work with a lot of speech sound disorders. So a lot of working on saying a specific sound accurately. And we see the biggest difference between a 5 and an 8-year-old working on the same sound. The 8-year-old, we really have to acknowledge and have it as part of our therapy session, working on confidence and making sure that the child is motivated. Whereas the 5-year-old has 3 years less of being aware that it's a problem.
Right.
I'll go to the other end of the spectrum in terms of, well, am I bringing my child in, whether they're a baby or a toddler or a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old, am I doing it too early? And again, I think that is such an individualistic response. And again, I'm going to go back to that frustration piece or that question of, I think we're in the parenting style for many people, at least the families that come in to see us, they're highly educated parents who are information seekers. And I think we have social media and the internet to thank for that. And I think it's very easy to get the information. And that can also breed a lot of anxiety. I don't know any SLPs, at least in Toronto, at least whoever I interact with, whether it's publicly funded or privately funded speech therapy, I don't know any SLP that will keep a child on their caseload if there's not a concern. So I always say, if your child is young, it's never too young to go in for an assessment. What the assessment does is it provides information for the parent to understand, was my concern correct? Will my child benefit from therapy, or is it my anxiety and everything is okay? So I always say it's never too early, because there's only two outcomes. One, think of how good it will feel if your speech language pathologist says, hey, guess what? Everything's great. Your child is doing wonderful. Your child will not benefit from speech therapy. Here's my door. Yeah. Go on your way. Whereas the other way, let's say we catch something at 18 months of age or 2 years of age and say, hey, you know what? I really love these skills. They're going very well. But it's these two skills that I think we can benefit. And that's why you have all those questions. And your child can benefit from therapy. And then the parent can gain all those tools to help their child. And so it's never too early.
I love that you mentioned that, because as a parent myself, whose child has been to a speech therapist, speech language pathologist, one thing that I can say is, you know, we often listen to our doctors or pediatricians who are like, they're fine. You know, it's not till this age. But then once you get to that age, then wait lists are so long, and then you're waiting another year to actually get help. And so I kind of wish that I had listened to my mommy gut and just gone earlier. The other thing is, you guys are amazing and you have the skills. Like, you're just like magicians, and you know all the skills and tricks to get to teach kids. And so as parents, we don't necessarily know that. Yeah. And so within one session, you can make so much change. And I'm just thinking of how frustrating it was for us as parents when it was like something as simple as like fronting, which my first child had. And, you know, for the longest time, instead of cake, she would say Tate. So sounds were T. And literally within the first session, like, she figured that out. And so my anxiety would have helped. It would have helped my anxiety as a new mom to actually go seek help earlier. And I wish that I even knew to do that. So I hope that people listening to this episode don't feel like they're bothering, because that's what I kind of felt like, oh, I don't want to waste their time. It's oh not goodness. That bad. And so that's kind of what I felt. I'm like, and I'm coming from the perspective of a physiotherapist, and it's interesting because I would have said the same thing. If you're worried about your child's physical development, why not go see somebody, an OT, PT, get an assessment. And then if you don't need help, then you don't need help. But I love the way that you approach that and the funding aspect, which a lot of people don't think about, is why is the TDSB or different school boards recommending don't get help till this age? Just because they probably can't afford to give your child that help until that age, until it's more severe. Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you. What sure. should parents look for when considering, you already mentioned this, you know, which they should consider whether or not they should reach out to a therapist, but can you tell me what that support should look like? So do they go directly, can they directly go contact a speech language pathologist, or do they need a referral?
Okay, great question. So can we talk about Ontario? Because yes. I know Ontario, but I think if you're in another province, the first thing that you should do is, I think, is do some research on publicly funded and privately funded in your individual area, because it's all so different what's public. From a private perspective, the only reason why you would need a doctor's referral is in terms of your individual, if you have individual private health insurance dollars.
Right.
If you're looking at the private realm, which is out of pocket, some insurance providers require a doctor to write off that the child needs speech therapy. It's right. like a prescription. Other insurances do not. But in terms of reaching out to a speech language pathologist privately, you do not need a doctor's referral. I do not need one. If Amazing. The parent has concerns,
that's enough.
Email me. That's enough. I actually also think I know from the preschool, it's the same. In the public sector in Ontario, we have two options. If your child is under JK, under junior kindergarten, you can go to the program, the preschool speech and language program. And I know that you do not need a doctor's referral. You just need to be within that postal code. You also do not need a health card.
Oh,
you do not. You can self-refer. It depends on where you are in the city of Toronto. And I also know, you know, the Toronto District School Board, Toronto Catholic School Board. I'm almost positive if York, Durham, Peel, you need to be nominated either by, for speech services, you either need to be nominated by your child's teacher or you need to be nominated by the school's principal.
Okay.
So doctors are not
involved with that.
Unless you need that referral slip for your own insurance.
Okay. Okay. So that at least removes some of the barriers. And I think for anybody who's listening in the States, everything is private. So I'm pretty sure that's a whole separate, you know, way to access.
I don't even know anything. I know it's very different how you access speech therapy in the States based on.
And you're provincially regulated, right? So you can only see clients within the province of Ontario. Okay. That's good to know too. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what are the parents' role in speech therapy? Is this a child's homework or is this the parents' homework? Or I'm just thinking, because a lot of your parents that are coming are probably busy, educated, mm-hmm. have jobs. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it can be overwhelming to think, oh, I'm already doing so much. I have this other extra thing that I'm going to have to do now. And mm-hmm. I think that might be a barrier for some people even starting speech therapy, because it's time out of your own hands too.
Yes. So I think this is really tough. And as a parent, I will admit it, I am the worst parent for homework. Everyone's really shocked because I give home practice all day long and we entrench it in daily routines like bath time, meals. And it's hard because let's say we look at the preschool side, children who are under four, we know the research shows, the empirical evidence shows that children, no matter what the delay is in communication, whether it's speech sounds or language, which is the ability to use words or the ability to use grammar, things like stuttering or social interaction skills, they learn best with their parents. So this term, you know, parents will drop their child off to daycare and then they don't see them again until five. So it's really important that when you only have that a couple of minutes to do, you know, you're doing mealtime, bath time, and then you're going to bed.
Yeah.
That's enough time to make a significant impact on your child's communication. So what we do is what we're really known for is parents as partners. It feels, it rarely never happens, mostly with the older children, but from a preschool child, anyone under four, is how we help is that the parent is always in the room during the speech therapy sessions, taking an active role, so they know exactly how to support their child when they get home during these small little moments that you're actually present and able to be with your child because you work full time and you have a very busy schedule. That is the only way that you're going to see success. And the only way that you're going to get out of the therapy room is, we always say, 5 minutes a day, 5 to 10 minutes a day. That's enough. And I think when you take that kind of pressure off, that you don't need to sit down and do speech therapy, you're going to implement those goals that we've set for your child during snack or while you're reading a book before it's time to go to bed. You're going to learn the best ways to use that book with your child so that you are really increasing their communication goals during set times.
Yeah, and it's woven in within things you're already doing.
Everything.
So there's no, because I think mental image of homework, we think it has to be the separate, dedicated half an hour. And I love when you're actually talking, because there's so many parallels between the work that you do and I do. And because I support a lot of new moms, I'm like, you don't need a half hour at the gym. You can weave in your own fitness movements 5 minutes a day throughout the course of your day and the things that you're already doing. And that's what's more sustainable for most people and actually doable and achievable. And as a parent who's child has been to speech therapy, that's, it works. It's like, it's amazing because you actually see it work. Like bath time, you're like, okay, let's work on this sound. And you're not even doing it as homework. You're just doing it in play. And that's kind of what you teach us, is just incorporate these sounds. And it's incredible seeing your child learn it, because you're like, oh, once you know how to teach, it's just, your child is good at learning, right? Can you tell me about the difference between speech sounds? Because you mentioned it briefly, speech sounds and speech, like language?
Language. So I think the best way is to kind of see it as a cake analogy. I use this cake analogy all the time.
Yeah.
I might have, oh, you saw Jackie. I'm pretty sure Jackie uses it as well. But no, then Misha came back and saw me. But by then we knew, okay.
Yeah.
I'll explain the cake analogy. So the cake analogy is, when you come to see a speech language pathologist, and I think this is really important for parents who have children, let's say between 12 months of age to 30 months of age, who have no words, are not saying anything. I think parents are really good at seeing whether or not their child is using words. It's visible. You can see it. My child's not using any words. I don't hear anything. And then a lot of parents are like, I don't know why. And so I think it's really important to see this cake analogy to find out why. So if you think about the cake, we want to break it up into two parts. So we have a bottom layer and we have an upper layer, because a two-layered cake is so much better than a single-layer cake.
Absolutely.
It is. The cake from Loblaws or Sobeys that's double-layered is better than like a carrot cake.
It's true. Scientifically proven.
Exactly. So like a carrot cake is fine, but you know, the two layer is the most delicious. So the bottom layer of the cake is, what do you understand? That is what SLPs call receptive language. It's what does the child know? Because if you don't know the word or you don't know the phrase, guess what? You're never going to say it. You need to have that knowledge of that word to be able to say it. It's like learning any other language. If you're going to learn a different language, I think you speak too, do you not? How many do you speak?
Up to four. So
oh my
English,
goodness.
French, Hindi, and Tamil. But I'm not fully fluent in Hindi and Tamil anymore, but I still, you know, speak enough of both. Yeah.
But I bet you understand more than what
yes.
you can say.
Oh, 100%. And it's so frustrating because I'm like, I understand everything. But then when you go to speak, you fumble your words, and then it's embarrassing as an adult, right? Because you're like, I should know how to say this. But yeah, I see what you mean with even children and that 8-year-old feeling a bit more like lacking confidence versus a 5-year-old is like, whatever, like I'll just say it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the bottom layer is understanding it, understanding a word. That is your knowledge. That is the language piece. The upper layer is the use of language, the expressive language piece. So that is where we look at sound development. Is the child babbling? Is the child making vocalizations? It also includes non-speaking forms of communication. Is the child using gestures like hands up, clapping, where gesture? Is the child pointing? Is the child shaking their head yes and no? Able to use a single word? Able to use a phrase?
Right.
Etc. So it's the late, it's what are you saying? Then what we do is we put that bare layered cake. It's just two layers with the icing in the middle, and we put it on a plate, because you cannot serve the cake, the language cake, without anything underneath, because it will fall apart.
Right.
That plate is social interaction. So your child should have that intentional desire to communicate with other people around them. So you can have a lot of language and understand, but if you're not engaged with other people, you may see delays within that plate. If the plate has holes in it, or it's a little bit flimsy or not as solid, the cake may fall through, even though it's such a beautifully baked cake.
It's a paper plate.
Yeah, it's a paper plate, or there's a little bit of some holes in it,
right.
Or it's a little bit, there's a little bit of a chip. And we've got to make it a little bit stronger. And so that I like to call the social interaction piece. And that may be why parents are seeing that their child's not using any words. It's because they're not engaging with other people around them, even though
Right.
they understand or have the words. I also add a little fork, because what we know is children learn through play. The fork is your play skills. So it's really important as a speech therapist, when you're doing the assessment, that we're not just looking at language, we're looking at how the child plays, because that gives us a lot of information on the child's language development. So the fork is the different kinds of play that we see, making sure that they have that great variety of pretend and constructive play and cause and effect and reciprocal play. And that's a whole other area to make sure that everything, the play skills are there. The last piece, which you're asking, is the speech piece. What does that mean? Where do the speech sounds come into play? And you can take, especially for a toddler, you can take that plate, that cake. Now it's two layers, it's sitting on a cake, and the fork is right there ready to eat. It tastes pretty good. But what makes that cake like the cherry on top is the icing. So if you put some icing on top of the cake, that is what we call speech sounds. So that is when a child says the single word that they have, is it coming out clear?
Right.
Okay. So that's how we differentiate between speech sounds, language, which is the cake batter, and interaction and play, which is the plate and the fork. And that is why assessments are so helpful for parents. I'll give an example of a child that came in to see me for an assessment. He had just turned 2 years of age, an incredibly intelligent child. It was very clear right off the bat, and for the parents, that the bottom batter was great. The child had about 10 to 20 words, which for a two-year-old is not enough. We want to see at least 100 single words and starting to combine it too. And was using gestures and an incredible amount of ability to use his body to communicate in a non-speaking way, which is what we love. Social skills and his play skills were beautiful. And parents had such great questions. The parent said to me, I don't understand why my child is not talking, because he has such a great desire to communicate and understands everything that we're saying. Why is he not talking? And by using this cake analogy and by assessing him as a speech language pathologist that has the skills in communication versus a doctor or someone else out of the scope of speech language pathology, I was able to assess and share with the parent that the reason why their child is not communicating is because the child's delay was actually at the top of the icing. The child was not able to use single words because their motor speech was impacted. And so what we see is that icing on the top, which is so visible for parents, it's coming out unclear. If you ever think about a Loblaws cupcake, if you try to scrape off the icing, like if the child complains to you, there's too much icing on my cake. If you smear off that icing is still a little bit there. It's impossible to get it completely off the batter.
Right.
And so what we know is speech sounds can impact expressive language, the language piece. And so it really takes a speech language pathologist to be able to look at the whole cake and share with the parent and say, this is why. And because we're working at, let's say, the upper layer, or because we're working, let's say we're working on the plate, or let's say we're working on the bottom layer, what we do as parents and speech language pathologists is very different. And so that's why an assessment is so important, because it's not a one size fits all outcome.
And
when
I,
a child, yeah.
I had, it's funny because you don't even realize how much you know as the practitioner, like the play skills. I didn't even think about that, that's part of the assessment, or the social interaction. And I do think that during the pandemic, so many children and families lacked social interaction, or there were many children who were just at home, parents working on the computer, children were watching TV or screens or playing by themselves. And I feel like that's a big piece that we don't even realize how much that impacts speech until it does. So that's incredible that. And this is why I always advocate for people to like go get the help, because
go get it done.
You have no idea how much you don't know as a parent and how much the provider has expertise in this, and it can ease your worries and your anxieties. And after having been through it with my child, like it's night and day, because now you know that that person, your child, understands everything and always has, but now they can actually express it, and you see the confidence building because they're able to express it and be heard and be clear and have the teachers and their friends understand them as well.
Yeah. One last thing I'll mention about what we've been talking about is, like, I loathe Facebook mom groups or parent groups. And I know they can be helpful. I know parents are, again, information seeking parents. We want, most important is word of mouth. I want to speak to, you know, a parent wants to speak to another parent that's gone through the same thing as me. But unfortunately, it's very hard to parse out, to find those fine nuances between, you know, when a parent will say, well, you know, my child was three, I had the exact same thing, we did this. But you may be speaking to another parent who was working on the bottom layer of the cake, whereas you, your child, actually needs to be working on the icing. So what worked for that parent may not necessarily be what your child needs.
Right.
So that's why I get really nervous on these Facebook groups, because a lot of times I see parents that say, oh no, you're okay, you don't need an assessment. Or the opposite way, they're like, oh, you need to. I'm like, in my head, I'm like, your child's fine. So I think really important to reach out to the professional. My favorite part is telling parents. My favorite part of my job is telling parents that everything's okay. So you don't need to be worried that, you know, an SLP is just in it for them. They're going to take, I mean, at least not me. We're not doing it for the money. We're not going to keep your child. Our wait lists are
unnecessarily. Yeah.
We're not going to keep your child. We're truly only going to keep your child if your child would benefit. So go for it.
And yeah, I also hate mom groups, because there's some good in it, but there's a lot of dangerous stuff and people telling people medical advice and health advice that I'm like, this is not your place. Just refer, please refer. Can you tell me what language or speech kids need when entering school, JK? So that's
Great
about
question.
The age of four in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yep. JK is a fascinating year. I'll tell you what they don't need. And I think I'll get some parents that are going to, their mouths are going to drop. From a language perspective, and let's look at the everything but the icing. So if we look at the language piece and the social piece and the play piece, I can tell you that your four-year-old going into JK does not need to know their colors. They do not need to know their numbers.
What?
I already see your, they do not, that is a skill that you learn in JK. That is part of the curriculum. They're going to learn it in JK. They do not need to know their colors. They do not need to know their numbers. They do not need to know shapes. They can know it. And the reason why I say that is because, one, your child is going to learn it in JK. It is a school-based concept. And the reason why it concerns me is because our current society has banged it over parents' heads that you must know these skills, and if not, your child is not smart, and this is what they need to be successful. But if you think about colors, it is maybe seven vocabulary words. It's red, blue, green, yellow, orange, etc. Right?
Yeah.
1 to 10.
Yeah.
Shapes, there's maybe like 5 or 6 main ones. So your child is maybe gaining 20 vocabulary words.
Right.
But from a language piece and a social piece, What do JK children need to be successful in school? They need to have playground skills. They need to know how to turn weights, wait for their turn before it's their turn to go up on the slide. They need to know how to play interactively with other children. They need to learn, how do I transitional skills. How do I transition from the carpet? And then how do I follow that direction to the table and sit down and engage? So I think those kinds of social skills, like I would think, you know, a vocabulary word such as, think about vocabulary. So things like help and my turn and stop. I don't like that.
Yeah.
Right? Are way more effective for children to be successful in the school versus a child that walks in with colors and numbers and shapes, but they have no, you know, their language skills are not as strong in other ways, and they're going to struggle. So I always say, if your child loves colors, sure, teach it, but do not forget about those playground skills. Even something like, I mean, I'm not an OT, I'm not a PT, you know, like how to open your lunchbox.
Yeah.
How do I put on my boots? How do I
how
dress myself and line up?
Take
at
your
the door?
Pants off to go to the bathroom and pull it back up yourself. Yeah.
You got it. And, or if you're struggling to do that, to be able to ask your teacher for help.
Right.
Right. To me, those are way more important than the later developing skills. I will say, I think it's important from, you know, a literacy perspective. Like, you know, parents always ask me, like, do they need to know A to Z? I go, nope. But you know what would be really helpful for them in JK? It's to be able to recognize their name, because their name is everywhere. It's by their coat hook. It's by where their boots should go. When they first start letter recognition, it depends on the school board, but many JK teachers will start with the child's name. So I think it is really helpful for children to recognize their own name, but everything else they're going to learn in JK. That's what they learn.
Wow. That is totally new to me. And that's amazing, because you don't really stop to think about what do those children really need. And I think from, depending on where you were raised and what culture and what background, academics is often so much, like there's so much pressure. Like I remember when I had my first, and I was at a mom group, like those early on centers, and there was a mom with a baby that was like 8 months old, and my daughter was like 9, 10 months old, and she was very interactive, or like could sit up or something. And then this mom knew I was a physiotherapist. So she was like, I'm just really worried because she's not doing this yet. And, you know, I'm worried she's behind. And I'm thinking, wow, that's so much pressure on your like pretty fresh baby. And you're now also comparing your baby to another baby. And even though your baby's a baby, they can still understand. Like, I feel like babies are smart. They might not be able to understand all the words, but they can understand a sense of like, hey, my mom thinks I'm not good enough, or my mom's putting this pressure on me. So I always say, like, instead of doing that and chatting with other moms who are also, for lack of a better term, the blind leading the blind in many ways, go ask the expert, right? Rather than comparing, oh, why does your child, they can say the, you know, ABCs, but mine can't. Well, maybe your child has different skills and different areas of,
exactly,
you know,
different strengths.
Yeah. So I love that. Can you tell me about neurodivergence? Because that's been a huge, not thing, but it's been more visible and there's more conversation around it. And I know that many parents are worried that their children who have speech needs also have neurodivergence. Is that true?
Yes. So a lot of children who are neurodiverse are more likely to have a speech and language delay. That's what we know. I will say that I'm not the best expert on neurodiversity. I'll share what I know and I've done, and I'll say what's really lovely and what's really amazing is a lot of, you know, a lot of speech language pathologists, including myself, have done a lot of unlearning. And I think speech language pathology is in such an incredible place right now, because we are finally, and I think it's been so helpful for these kids, that it's no longer a fear to get a diagnosis, and that it's actually a plus. And so I find that we're no longer trying to fit a neurodiverse child into a square box that where they don't belong. And I think we are finally being inclusive and recognizing that it is a difference, not a delay. And so that's why I went back to that. That's where that plate piece is. That's where we see a lot of the neurodivergence, is that social interaction piece. And I think it's really, really, I would say in the last 3 years, when I first started my schooling and when I first started my practice, like my first 15 years of practice, we saw it as a social interaction delay. And now what we're learning is that it's not a delay. Children who are neurodiverse, let's bring up autism. What the research is finding out is that children who are autistic can interact appropriately with one another. So it is not necessarily, it's not a delay, it's a difference. And so, and it goes to that, I think it's so lovely, we're going to that double empathy problem, that the neurodiverse child does not, it's not their job to fit into the neurotypical world. It's up to both neurotypicals and neurodiverse populations to understand that double empathy bias and recognize that there's a difference and work through that. So, you know, I think it's important, as I, for example, I have two neurotypical children, and it's been very eye-opening for me that it's not only important for us as parents to teach our children that there are differences in the world and that we need to be caring and inclusive, but I also think it's really important to share with your neurotypical children that they have a job to do as well.
Right.
And it's
empower
and it's
them.
And it's to understand this idea of ableism. It's to understand that neurotypical children are not better. They're not the better ones compared to a neurodiverse child, that everyone should be recognized, and that it's really important to reflect on that, that that neurodiverse child can teach you. A neurodiverse child is going to teach you and be a part of that interaction, and you're both going to learn together, versus this dichotomy that it
hierarchy,
used to be. That it used to be a delay. And so even though I'm not an expert, I've been doing so much unlearning, and I think we are finally seeing, not that we didn't, we're the success that we're seeing in social interaction therapy for these children who have diagnoses. It's amazing how just the therapist changing their approaches, how much more kinder the therapy has been, the progress that these children are making. So yes, we're seeing a lot of neurodiversity, and I'm within speech and language delays. And I think, I hope, parents used to come in, and when they got that a diagnosis, let's say autism, there was a lot of tears and a lot of mourning over the loss of their child's future. And I'm really hopeful with, I think I would always suggest to parents who have neurodiverse children is to listen to neurodiverse voices. I'm not one of them, so I'm not the right person, but listen to neurodiverse voices. And I think there is a lot of hope, and I think there's a lot of potential for neurodiverse children to be very successful in the world. But I do think it takes both sides to truly make that happen. I think we're getting there, but I think we've got a long way to go. Yeah. And so I've been doing a lot of listening to change my ways.
Cause that's the reality. Is I don't know how many years you've been in practice, but when I went to school 12, 13 years ago, there were so many ways that we learned that were, you know, would not work now. Right.
No.
Everything we learned was from a very male Eurocentric lens, what a normal body is, what normal posture is. And when you actually look at, like, hey, women actually don't stand like that. You know, Black women don't stand like that. Brown, like, there's so many layers. And if you're in a wheelchair, your scoliosis is maybe normal because you're pushing with one side. Like, there's so many other things to consider. And I really think that we're only going to be learning more. And I like what you said about listening to people's voices. Maybe there, I'm sure there are many other speech language pathologists and practitioners who are neurodiverse themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, seeking out that type of support so that you and your family, you also don't feel alone in this process, because what we know is there's always been neurodiversity. It's just never been recognized, or it's been seen as a weakness or as a delay, like you said. And now we're understanding that it's not a weakness, better or worse. It's just a difference from, you know, different experiences. Mm-hmm. Tell me about babbling babies.
Okay. So babbling babies is was like my passion project. It is a baby program. It's interactive. It's 8 weeks long. It's for both parent and baby. It is a 45-minute class. It is part learning strategies, what SLPs use, what does the knowledge show us about baby development, their speech and language development, their play development in babyhood, providing some strategies and awareness of how to promote your child's communication. And we do the other half is play. So I don't know if you've seen pictures of our, I don't know if you went into our toy, you've probably seen our toy room.
Yeah.
So
which is amazing.
It's pretty intense. And so, because again, think about that analogy, everything is through play. So not that you need to have you can just have one toy and that's enough, but really helping parents to understand, what does play look like in babyhood or toddlerhood, and what are our favorite toys that we like to play with? And what does it mean by a favorite toy? It means that we have interacted using this toy with so many babies that age. We've had all that experience, and recognizing what's a better toy for a baby versus another toy on the market. And that goes back to our discussion on shapes and colors and numbers, right? Is that so much of the toys that are on the market, they're battery operated, and they bombard these babies with, again, concepts and vocabulary that is not meaningful or useful. We like to use, I think in your profession as well, functional. It's not functional. It's not meaningful for the baby at that moment in time. So we do a lot of our work in this program of sharing with parents, these are the toys that we like. So, for example, no batteries, ones that go across the full spectrum of play. So cause, effect, constructive. We do a lot of book reading. How do we like to read the book? What does this research shows about reading books to children to promote communication? And then it's really fun for the babies. So the babies get a chance to play. The babies get to interact. The parents get to interact with each other and have that bond. It's a small class, less than 10. And so the reason why I started the program is because when my children were babies, at least in Toronto, what was available to us was a lot of music classes, and not that there was anything wrong with the music classes. They were some were really lovely. Some, as a speech language pathologist, I was dying inside because it was either too loud or again, focusing on the wrong concepts. And so from there, I thought to myself, I could provide something to parents that is going to be useful. So it's not just for the baby to get something out of it, but it's also something for the parent to learn about and then take it with them when they're home with their baby, all those long hours at home. So that's why it was developed. And it's now been trademarked, and
that's amazing.
An e-course that goes with it. So it's my little passion project.
And do you run it at your current clinic?
We do. Nice. Yeah. So right now we have a new clinic. Right now we only run it at our locations. Pre-pandemic, we used to run it in other people's homes. But now with this high need for private speech and language therapy, there's only so much that we can do. So we've made the decision to only have it within our own
Makes
space
sense.
Just because we don't, it's just a time issue.
It's
a great, I love the program. I think it's really, we hear that it's really parents really appreciate it, that it's not just for the baby who loves it, but it's also the parents can get something out of it as well.
Because listen, when your kids can communicate more effectively, it makes your life easier, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of frustration and tantrums, I feel like, from the lack of understanding each other and just even understanding how babies communicate. One of my friends is an SLP. So I remember, like, I will never forget this. Her daughter was like 16 months old. My daughter was probably like 8 months old. And she'd come over and her daughter was like saying words like elephant so clearly. And I was like, how is this kid speaking so clearly? And she's like, I've just been basically doing speech therapy with her since she was born, because she has those skills. And I would look at how she communicates with her child and so clearly and with animation. And mm-hmm. I'm like, there are actual skills that you have as a speech language pathologist to teach children. And I feel like there's so much parents can learn from something like Babbling Babies, where then you learn how to interact more clearly, more effectively with your child and have more fun with it too. Because guess what? I didn't grow up having kids' books read to me. I didn't have that experience. When I became a parent, there was a lot of learning about how to parent, because I grew up in India and there was different, it wasn't bad or it wasn't better or worse. It was just different, right? There's different childhood. Even the toys now, right? Just to see, like, when I brought my daughter in, like, what kind of toys she liked to play with, because some of them we never even played with before. And she would come home and be like, I love that, mm-hmm. you know, dinosaur toy or whatever it was. And it's just interesting, like, learning about what your child likes.
And that's part of it too, because they can test out that, you know, each week we present a play development and the babies get to test out. And so parents can see, oh, they really liked that toy. They really liked that toy. And so then you have a better ability to have like a curated toy library
toy
in your
space.
own home.
Yeah.
Toy space, so that you're not, you know, bombarded with so many toys that your child is not interested in.
Yes.
And keep toys out of the landfill. And
yes.
Exactly. So that's what we try to do.
And you're right, there's so many music programs for babies. It was like everywhere mm-hmm. I went, there was like mm-hmm. baby mommy music. And so for me, mm-hmm. I created my postpartum return to exercise program. So there was something mm-hmm. for the mother too. Because when the mom feels better, the baby's going to feel better too, when you're feeling better about yourself and your body and everything. So I love that our own experiences in parenting kind of created something good, you know, something magical that came out of it. I have some questions for you, because you're an entrepreneur, you're a mom, you're busy, you're doing so much. What are three things that you like to do for yourself for self-care every day? Do you do anything, first of all?
Oh, wow. This is a great question.
And self-care. It doesn't have to be big. Like, doesn't have to be a bath or a mask or, you know.
No. I do. I don't know if this counts as self-care, but to me, it's very much my self-care and how I, you know, I get asked this question, how do you make this work? And my self-care is asking for help. So my self-care is making sure that I have other people in my life who are able to support me. So for example, I am a type A individual. You can't figure that out yet. I think most that's what people are. I'm the kind of person that if I don't think I'm good at it, let's say cooking, I'm a terrible cook.
Same.
I cannot do it. And it caused me a lot of anxiety when I got home with my children at 5 o'clock. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I have to get something that I have to feed them. And I'm like, I can't do this. And that 30 minutes of time that I took where I felt so bad about myself. And then my kids would just be like, ew, this is disgusting.
Yeah. They're like, this is gross, mommy. And you're like, great. They spent all that time. Yeah.
So I'm the kind of person that believes, and again, I understand that this comes from a place where you need to have that financial backing. But for me, it was really important that what am I going to do with this finite amount of time? If I only have 45 minutes of spare time, I want to be doing, you know, being on a podcast or doing something for my kids that I'm very good at, like, I don't know, gathering boots for them. I'm really great at picking out boots for them, but the cooking I cannot do. And so I reached out and found support that I pay for.
Amazing. Yeah.
So that I am then available to do other things that I'm very good at. Yeah. So for me, my self-care is not feeling bad about asking for help and paying for it. Because I believe if I only have an hour of time, it better be doing something that one, I love, and two, that I'm good at.
Yeah.
Because I think that just helps my family out.
Yeah. And it also helps you feel better at the end of the day. And you're not feeling guilty about not being the mom who does XYZ because that's what society has told us. You're like, you know what? I'm honoring what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And
you got it.
Getting help. That's amazing.
Yeah. And so I found someone who's an amazing chef, right? Who has become part of our family, right?
Amazing.
And those are the things that I spend my my money on is because that's going to make me, that's my self-care, is not, it's reaching out for help. It is, honestly.
And so what is something that you are really passionate about right now?
Great question. Does it have to be in speech or other things?
No, absolutely not. It doesn't have to be work related, career related.
What am I really passionate about? You know what? I think from a speech perspective, what I'm really passionate about is post-pandemic. I think whatever your thoughts were during the moment, what we are seeing in our assessments, the children are definitely coming in differently. Not necessarily better or worse, but children are communicating differently versus how they were coming in as a whole, let's say pre-pandemic. So I've been it's been a little bit more of a passion for me about this, and we're seeing different anxiety levels in parents. So just going back to, I'm really passionate even more so now about getting our children in early, because there's such a high need for speech therapy, because we're seeing differences post-pandemic. So that's one passion of mine. And the other passion of mine, which has also really helped me feel better, is I've been working out more. So
amazing.
I used to just here and there, and what I've really learned, what someone in the
physiotherapy fitness space
shared with me is just how you would, book a client in. I had to book in my gym time.
Oh yeah.
And
it's gotta be in your schedule. Yeah.
So that has made a big change of mine in terms of my energy level, my ability to be, I just find I'm more calm and relaxed, and I feel, I feel stronger. Yes. But it's really helped me everywhere. So picking up exercise has been a big change, I would say, within the last year.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
that's
been
awesome.
One of my passions.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you said the other part with the pandemic, because I notice it's not just the plate analogy. It's not just the children's plate. It's probably the parents' plate too. I, even talking to adults, I'm like, you haven't been around talking to people as much recently, because some people are more socially awkward, or they feel like there's more anxiety. There's just less of that village of community. And so it's probably not necessarily affecting adult speech, but just their general levels of calm in their day, which then rubs off on the rest of your family too, mm-hmm. as a parent. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you could change one thing about the world, what would it be?
Oh my goodness. If I could change one thing about the world. Right now, I think one thing I would change about the world, this is such a great question. I think a lot of the times what comes out, I work with children. I love working with children. And I think I just want nice kids. I don't care how smart, I mean, we all want our children to succeed.
Yeah.
Again, it goes back to entry into JK, and I think everything that I've been sharing, I think number one is to have children that are nice and kind and respectful, aware of, other people in their lives. And what would I want in the world is just a general, I don't think it's an easy answer. I don't think there's an easy fix, but I think it would be being nice, for more people to be nice and understanding. And I think we have to really consider anxiety levels of parents. I think that would be a big thing for me, that what I would love. I think it's important that we each try. For example, when we opened up our space, I was able to build it from, how I wanted it to look. And I, again, what you said, it's not just the child's plate, but it's the parent's plate. I designed the waiting room actually more for the parent than the child. I mean, it's fun for the child. There's lots of little springy toys and boing boing toys and waiting
Yes.
books and stuff. But I wanted parents to walk in, and I wanted it to feel like their own home. I wanted to feel very comfy, because I wanted parents' anxiety levels to go down. So I think your question of, I would love for everyone to be a little bit, I would love to look at that anxiety piece I think there's a lot of pressure in the world. And that
Yes.
whole nice piece, I think, is what I would love for the world. Yeah.
More
But
kindness
not
and more
easy.
consideration for each other. I know it's not easy, but it's, I think you're doing it. Like if we're all addressing, not addressing, but creating space like that, environment like that in our own homes, there has to be a ripple effect. You know what I mean? Like there has to be, each of us impacts so many people around us. And the more we can do the things that help us feel calm and kind and nice to the people around us instead of, and the things that bring our own anxieties down, the better our whole family and communities are. And for me, exercise is a big part of it for me too. Anxiety, calm, like everything. I feel better. I'm a better human. I think we're all better humans when we're able to exercise regularly. And it doesn't have to be at the gym. It can be at home. It can be going for a walk. It can look so many different ways. And I think you answered this piece already, but what do you think is your biggest mom strength?
My biggest mom strength. I don't necessarily know if it's a strength or something I've been really cognizant of and one of my goals, and I'm still working on it, but I'm going to say it's a strength because I've been really trying, is to listen. And I think it's the hardest thing I've worked on is to take some time to, I think it's so easy for us to, you know, to
react,
react and share all our knowledge and help our children to learn. And trust me, I struggle with it, but I think is to, again, that calmness and try to reduce anxiety levels and really to listen to my children. It's so hard, but not to be as reactive. And I've been trying to listen more and say less. And that's hard for a speech language pathologist.
It's true.
I'm really trying to listen.
How old are your kids?
They're old now. They're 7.5 and 9. They're pretty old. There's a lot going on. Yeah.
And it's funny because you always think it's going to be really busy when you have a young baby and toddler. And you're like, it is, but it only gets busier in many ways because kids have their own needs, interests, activities, and it's really interesting. I love that. That's a huge skill and something I'm working on as well. Cause so often as parents, we want to just offer solutions right away and fix all their problems and tell them what we would do. And sometimes that's like, oh, well, that then they don't actually develop the skill of problem solving. They don't actually develop the skill of, you know, working through this. And so that listening piece is so huge. Thank you, Rebecca, for sharing all of your knowledge and expertise. I think
Thanks
this is such a helpful episode for people who, for every single person who has had a child, I think this is really helpful. I didn't know anything about speech language pathology, even though I went to U of T for physiotherapy and we shared a building.
Yeah, we did.
Despite that, I wish there was more interaction. 2011.
So I was 2007. So yeah. So that's why we didn't cross paths, but we never really did with the PTs or the OTs.
I know. Yeah. Like my friend from high school, Helen Livschitz, who's the one who referred me to you, went to speech therapy school, speech SLP program the same time I was in PT. And I'm like, I saw her maybe once or twice. Like there's just so little interaction. And I think what you said about, or the importance of like interdisciplinary care is also key, is sometimes as a PT, I might recognize that anxiety that mom has about breastfeeding and refer them to a lactation consultant or mental health or even their kid's speech. And so understanding each other's roles to me is really important so that we can make those referrals and ease people's anxieties and worries and just help people live a better quality of life. This episode will probably come out either end of December or early January. Where can people find you? What's your website, social media? How can people connect with you?
So on social media, we are bespoke.speech. So bespoke.speech. And then it's the same similar website. It's bespokespeech.ca.com.
Mine is .ca too.
Well, we're Canadian. Let's be proud Canadian.
But exactly.
Also, I can't afford the .com. And and if you live in Midtown Toronto, we just opened up our new clinic space that is in the Humewood, Cedarville, Wychwood area. So it is 845 St. Clair Avenue West. So if you ever want to pop in and say hi, just email me and I'm happy to show you around, as long as you're not an axe murderer.
Yes, we need to qualify that.
Yeah, so call me first. And so those I would say is Instagram, our website,
amazing,
and our physical location.
And now you've expanded, am I right, to a like that bigger location?
Yeah.
What's your wait list like? Do you have a wait list for people trying to get in?
Great question. So there are three main therapists. You know all of them.
Yes.
We have three main ones. Two of my colleagues came on because we just opened in September. Two of my colleagues came on full time.
Nice.
So from September until about now, December, it's the worst time to be looking for services.
Yeah, because it's like end of year, everyone's trying to get
in. End of year. I will say at this point in time, we did not have a wait list. It was the most glorious time. Right now, we just became full, like all three of us. We have a couple of other colleagues who work here and there, like half day. Right now we're all full, but the glory of working with preschoolers and school age children who are working on speech sounds is that kids make really good change. So I always say working with us, we're a revolving door.
Yeah.
So even though right now we have a small wait list, which I think is pretty good for in-person practice in Midtown Toronto.
Yeah.
It's a small wait list, but it's not a long wait list. So depending on, you know, if you want like an after school slot or early morning slot, those are the ones that fly out the window. But if you want to come during the day, you'll be getting in pretty quickly. After school depends. It depends on your schedule, but it's a pretty small wait list and it goes fast, at least for us.
And I will say that sometimes it's worth it to come, like, because I think we always came kind of morning, but like midday morning, like it wasn't 8 a.m. And sometimes it's worth it to just take the time of your day and do it, because like you said, it's not like you're going to be in there. You're not always going to be in there for months and months and months. Like kids make progress really quickly. And I'm so glad we did that, because then your child makes the progress and then you're good, or then you're good for a little bit. So same with physiotherapy. People are like, oh, I can only do it this time. I'm like, honestly, you're not going to need that much. You just need a few visits and it's inconvenient for a month or two and then you're good. So I love that. I will share all the details, your website, social media, when this episode comes out. Thank you all for listening. If this episode was helpful, share this with a friend. When you see people ask questions about SLP and mom groups, share this episode with them instead of, trying to offer advice from a non-expert perspective. I always like to refer people onto people like you. So thank you so much, Rebecca.
You're welcome.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Mom Strength and being part of this important conversation. Check out the show notes for more info and links, and we'll chat again real soon.